Welcome to Chapter 4 on Mutual Funds, Investments for the Masses. Dear students, probably this chapter is going to be the most important chapter for most of you. And why is that? Because as you enter the benevolent machine called the Great American Economic System, chances are you're going to work for a company that will not have what is called a defined benefit plan or the traditional pension plan. They're going away. You are probably going to be offered a defined contribution plan, also called an employer-sponsored retirement plan. And they go by various names, and the most popular is the 401k, but there are other types of employer-sponsored pension plans. The task of planning for your retirement is squarely on your shoulders. It used to be that you worked for a company for many years, and they would put money aside for you. And sometimes you would contribute also. But those days are gone. Now it's up to you to contribute. And often your company will help you. They will match, sometimes very generously. But you're the one who's going to have to do it. And we'll discuss this at the end of the semester. We'll take a look at a few plans and how they work. And we discuss this at length in the financial planning and money management class. But virtually all of these systems use mutual funds for their investments. Some of them allow you to buy and sell your own stocks and bonds and other securities, but that's rare. That's the exception, not the norm. So I've spent 2 minutes explaining this. Why? Because I want you to pay careful attention to this chapter, okay? And that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons we put it before we get to stocks and bonds. In some textbooks, in some classes, they will wait until after you go through stocks and bonds and other securities to discuss mutual funds. And there are advantages to that system, but I think the advantages to putting it before are greater. There's disadvantages to putting it before, and that's we don't really know what stocks and bonds are yet, do we? I mean, we have a vague idea from our overview of investment types, but we will be referencing things that we will not discuss in detail until later chapters. Oh, sorry, nothing's perfect. So let's get started with slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? Well, we learned that mutual funds are a type of investment company. That's the legal term. And there are other types of investment companies other than mutual funds, but those are certainly the most popular. And we read on slide number 2 that an investment company is a company that invests its shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. And as we said, investment company is the legal term. You will not hear anybody use that unless you're in the industry. Everybody else will use mutual fund. And what are the two glorious, phenomenal, usually, not always, benefits we get from our mutual funds? Professional money management and diversification. So, boy, I want you to do... When you try to explain a mutual fund to somebody, you have to hit on those 2 points because those are the big benefits. Now, sometimes they're not as fabulous and fantastic as we want them to be, and sometimes they are. So, but those are the two things we really need to stress when we discuss mutual funds. Each fund has a specific objective, meaning this one is for growth, this one is for income, this one is for preservation of capital. And there are over 10,000 funds I have a hard time believing that. Well, they double count some of them, but still, do you walk into a grocery store, are there 10,000 different types of breakfast cereals? Sometimes it seems that way, doesn't it? you have 10,000 different cars or shoes to choose? Well, I guess, I don't know. No. The mutual fund industry has exploded, and we will see some of the reasons why as we go along. As we said, many people choose mutual funds for their retirement account investments, 401ks, 403bs, their IRAs, traditional and Roth, etc., etc., etc. So slide number 3. This is my graph. Aren't you proud of me? I made this all by myself. And here we are. Let's get the cursor in here. Here we are, folks. We're the little people. And more of them are women, because women realize that they can't rely on the guy, the man of the house, to do the investing. They saw what happened to their mother, their grandmother, the man of the house who acted like he knew what he was doing, turned out didn't know what he was doing, and died before the grandmother and left her basically holding the bag. So women are taking their finances into their own hands. And it turns out that women make better investors. It's already been statistically shown with empirical data. Mm-hmm. And so we little people here, we give our $50 a month or $100 a month or more if we have it to the people in the top hats. And thankfully more and more they're women, because it turns out women are better investors. Did I say that already? I think I did. And they create a pool of money. Yeah, I know it. Doesn't look like, it's supposed to look like a little pond or pool. I know it looks like a potato, but still, there are millions of people giving billions of dollars to these professional money managers, these portfolio managers, these mutual fund managers, these, they go by various names, star managers, and these mutual funds have billions of dollars in them. And so what do? Well, if it's a stock mutual fund, they buy stocks. And if it's a bond mutual fund, they buy bonds. If it's a money market mutual fund, as we discussed in Chapter 1, they buy the cash instruments, treasury bills, corporate paper, and the like. But usually what happens is the term money mutual fund disappears, and you just hear people use the term money market. But it's a money market mutual fund. And then what we see right here is the beginnings of the explosion of different types of mutual funds, because there are mutual funds called balanced mutual funds that invest in both stocks and bonds. See? And we'll get to that later. Oh boy, will we get to that later. Slide number 4. Look at the growth of the mutual fund industry. Now, the data for 2012 is not, the definitive data is not available yet. I apologize. It won't be available for at least about 2 months from the ICI, the Investment Company Institute. But they give out preliminary data, but it's sketchy and sometimes it contradicts itself. So I wait until they call it their yearbook. I wait until their yearbook comes out before I publish it. And what we see here is that in 1940, when the Investment Company Act of 1940 was created, there were already 70 mutual funds out there before the investment company regulated investment company act came about. There were already 70 out there, and then 30 years later, the industry had grown considerably from 70 to 350, and then between 1970 to 1980 it grew to 600, and then oh boy, with the bull market starting in 1982, we see from 600 to 2000, and then from 1990 to 2000, then the roaring 90s, right? The 9,000 mutual funds, and in the last decade and some, we've gone up to 10,664, and that number is going to rise a bit, but the growth is nowhere near what it used to be. Why? Because there are already too many of the darn things. And if you look at the bottom, it says includes open-end, closed-end, ETS, relax. We're going to discuss those in the coming slides. Slide number 5. In 1980, 5 million Americans owned mutual funds. That was 3% of the nation's household financial assets. As of December 2011, there were 92 million Americans and 52 million households owning mutual funds. Now, why is that? Partially is because of the incredible run-up in the market between 1982 and 2000, but also the growth, the exponential growth of 401k plans, 403b plans, simple IRAs, SEP IRAs, and all the other cousins and different types of retirement plans. That's approximately 44% of all U.S. households owning mutual funds. So about almost 1 in 2. And as of December 2011, the total amount owned, I mean total amount of dollars in mutual funds was $13 trillion, with a T, almost as much as our national gross national product, a yearly gross national product. And that was 23% of the nation's household financial assets. Mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary, meaning they hold money for somebody else, excuse me with the mouse there, followed by commercial banks, and the life insurance companies, the invisible bankers. Right. Now, where did I get this data from? Again, from the Investment Company Institute, which is their the mutual fund industry's nonprofit advocacy group and trade group. It's the mother load of data on mutual funds. And so check out ICI.org if you're a statistics kind of person. And what I've been able to glean from, you know, bouncing around just recently is that they're now up to about $14 trillion. About $14 trillion. Of course, last year was a pretty good year for stocks. So-so year for bonds. Some bonds did well, some bonds did sort of okay. And then, of course, money markets did nothing because they're paying nothing, right? So now we're up to $14 trillion, but we'll know definitively in a couple of months. Now, look at the little bottom where I apologize, it's kind of small, but at the end of 2010, the amount was $13 trillion. So you see, 2011 was kind of a flat year. At the end of 2009, it was $12.16 trillion. At the end of 2008, it was $10.35 trillion. And at the end of 2007, it was almost $13 trillion. So you see what happened? Ooh, 2008 was a very rough year. And the stock funds got clobbered. The bond funds got clobbered too, but not as bad as the stock funds. And the money market basically did nothing because interest rates went to zero. So they held their own, but they didn't go down as much. So you see, we're still digging ourselves. Well, actually, we're back up, right? We see we're $14 trillion now at the end of 2012. So slide number 6. What are the advantages? Well, we've already discussed in detail, maybe not that much detail, but I've already hammered upon you the need for you to remember the two major advantages, diversification and professional money management. And diversification we will discuss throughout the semester, and we'll discuss it in detail after we've gotten done. Interesting how we try to tie all, we start from the beginning and we end at the beginning. We start from the end We go back and forth. A process where investors buy into a diversified portfolio of securities for the collective benefit of the individual investors. You see, most of us just don't have the resources available to buy enough stocks, bonds, to diversify. We just, you know, we're little people. That's why we call in the mutual funds investments for the masses. And so by pooling our money together with other investors, the professional money managers are able to diversify for us. So our $50 buys 25 cents of IBM and 30 cents of 3M, Minnesota Mining and Materials, the company that makes Scotch tape for you, and 50 cents of General Electric, and 10 cents of McDonald's. You with me? Understand? That's how it works. That's how it works. Now, the professional money managers are supposed to know what they're doing, and they certainly get paid enough. And some do a phenomenal job, folks. Over decades, they've done very well. And some don't do such a phenomenal job. And sometimes they do a great job, and then they turn around and do a bad job, and vice versa. But you certainly would want to be a mutual fund manager when you grow up, if you were so inclined, because they get paid very well. Now, a third benefit that we've already hinted at is that you don't have to have a whole lot of money. You can start with $50 a month. Some as little as $25 a month. I try to get people to think at least 50. Come on, how much is your cell phone payment? Oh, it's $130. It is? Yeah, okay. And then another factor that I have a renewed appreciation for, folks. I want to tell you, after getting involved in real estate these past few years, I have a renewed appreciation for the PETA factor. Now, I didn't come up with this name. I wish I had. I got it from The Wealthy Barber, a wonderful book written in the mid to later 1980s, 88 or so, I think he wrote, I'm not sure. And he called it the PETA factor. What does PETA stand for? Pain in the... Right. Exactly. They're easy, folks. Once you've made your decisions, once you've done your research or had an advisor recommend them and you trust that advisor, you're done. They do all the work for you. You just make sure that you are consistently funding your retirement account or your college education account or your home buying account, whatever you're using the fund for. You just need to be consistent and hang on when, you know, when the markets are volatile and the like. But they do all the buying and selling and all that for you. And after dealing with real estate, I certainly say. Slide number 7. Now, what are the drawbacks? Well, nothing's perfect. No investment is perfect. And we do have to pay for these people. They're not non-profit organizations. Transaction costs. Some mutual funds charge sales fees called loads, front-end loads, back-end loads, sideways loads, ups. Well, no. We'll discuss that in detail in the next presentation. And many others are no-load funds. What would you rather? Pay a sales charge or not pay a sales charge? Well, be careful. Some no-load funds can wind up costing you more than load funds over time. Right? Now, how could that work? Well, because of the next group, which is always there, annual operating expenses. Every mutual fund, every investment is going to have annual operating expenses. And they typically range from about 0.5, some less, to 2.5%, some more, but that's unusual, folks. They run sometimes around less than 1% up to 2%. That's the norm. Now, some are very inexpensive and some are very expensive, and we'll discuss that later on. And many mutual funds do not match the market's performance. Wait a minute. Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they are doing? Well, folks, these are the best and the brightest. But they're not always as good as we'd like them to be. And it turns out, as we'll see, it's difficult. It is not easy to pick stocks. It's a lot easier to pick bonds. But still, there are people who have a knack for it and do really, really well, and other people who make bad mistakes. But as we'll discuss, mutual funds have some serious drawbacks for the manager. If you're trying to beat the market, the first thing you have to realize is that you have these expenses that the market doesn't have. So the market just is what it is, and it gets 10%. Well, if you are charging 1% to manage your fund, and that's pretty typical, it's a little low for some funds, a little high for others. You have to do 11% just to, you understand, just to break even. Yeah. So, and this is true of any individual. If you're going to buy and sell your own stocks, you are going to incur, and bonds, you're going to incur transaction costs. And so if you plan to beat the market, you have to realize that you're going to have to, you know, make up for the commissions that are charged to you. So that's one of the reasons. We'll discuss other reasons later on. Slide number 8. Now, you as students in Business 123, Introduction to Investments, really do need to know the distinction between open-end and closed-end fund. Chances are, folks, you will never own a closed-end fund. They're just not that popular. They're not that important. In fact, that universe is shrinking. But you need to understand the difference. Open-end funds are by far the most popular mutual funds. And notice on slide number 8, we say they are greater than 90% of all mutual funds. An open-end mutual fund is a type of investment company in which investors buy shares from and sell them back to the mutual fund company itself. There's no limit on the number of shares that the fund can issue. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of the investors. So you can buy shares from, that's called purchasing shares, and sell shares back to, redeeming the shares, the investment company at any time. So you see, you deal with the investment company. Now, sometimes you deal through a broker, but still, you have however much money you have, $100,000, $50, you send it to the mutual fund company, and they issue to you. You purchase the shares. And then when you need your money, you don't say, I want to sell these shares. You just say, I need my $1,000 or my $10,000 or my $100,000, and they will then redeem, essentially destroy the shares. So when you send them money, they create shares. You purchase them, they issue them, they create them. And then when you pull your money out, they destroy them. You redeem the shares. And when people refer to a mutual fund, unless they specifically say this is a closed-end fund, they are exclusively referring to open-end mutual funds. And as of December 11, there were 8,684 of these open-end mutual funds totaling $11.6 trillion in assets. So remember, there were $13 trillion in at the end of 2011, right, and 11.6 of that was invested in open-end mutual funds. Now, what are closed-end funds? Notice they represent less than 10%, and the number is shrinking. It's a type of investment company that operates with a fixed number of shares outstanding. So the shares are issued by the investment company only when the fund is organized. So a bunch of people get together, CPAs and lawyers and mutual fund managers and the board of directors, and they say, we're going to issue 10 million shares of this mutual fund, this closed-end mutual fund, and we're going to be investing that money in stocks. After all the original shares are sold, mostly through brokers, you can only purchase the shares from another investor. So they look like a stock. They are bought and sold like stocks on the open market, on the exchanges, which we'll discuss when we get to Chapter 5. So you incur brokerage commissions. Closed-end mutual funds are not as popular with individual investors as open-end investment companies. At the end of December 2011, there were only 634 closed-end mutual funds holding only $239 billion. Now, that's a lot of money, folks, but compare it to the $11.6 trillion, with a T, that was in open-end mutual funds, and you see that closed-end are just, they're a much, much smaller part of the pie when it comes to mutual funds. But you still need to know the difference in Business 123. Okay, Introduction to Investments, you need to know the difference, even though chances are you'll probably never invest in these things. Slide number 10, Net Asset Value, NAV. The underlying value of one share in a particular mutual fund. Now, you don't have to do this calculation. The book asks you to do a few. I don't ask you to do a few. It's all done for you. Add up the value of the securities in the mutual fund, and this has to be done every day that the market in New York is open. At the end of the day, the mutual fund is required by the Investment Company Act to add up the value of the securities in the mutual fund, and then they subtract any liabilities. Now, that sounds like, wait a minute, did they borrow? No, they might have some investors who have redeemed their shares and they need to pay them, or they may have purchased some securities and they need to deliver the funds. So those are the liabilities, and they're very small. And then you divide by the number of shares that are outstanding, whether it's an open-end fund or a closed-end fund. Open-end funds are sold at net asset value. Every day, once a day, the mutual fund calculates what the mutual fund shares, each share is worth, and then that's the price you get. Now, if there's a sales charge, they add the commission to that. But closed-end funds are bought and sold on the open market. They're bought and sold like stocks, and the price changes all the time. So since they're bought and sold on the open market, their price usually either reflects a premium or a discount to the net asset value. So the mutual fund company calculates the value of the securities and then subtracts any liabilities, which are very tiny, and then divides by the number of shares and says, hey, this share, one share, the net asset value is $10. But because it's a closed-end fund being bought and sold at all, whenever the market's open, it might sell for $10.25 or $9.75. It might sell at a premium or a discount. The actuality is that they're often sold at a discount. And you say, cool, I can buy $10 for $9.75. Great! But then when you go to sell it, it's still selling at a discount. Right. They are very rarely priced at their net asset value. Slide number 11. This is the formula, which again, I'm not going to ask you to do. You don't have to do it, but I mean, it's not that hard. You take the value of the fund's portfolio, whatever that happens to be, and you subtract out whatever money needs to be paid to shareholders or for the purchase of a security, whatever liabilities, maybe the rent, who knows. And then you divide that by the number of shares outstanding. So this example, we have $10,050,000 worth of securities, and we have $50,000 that we have to pay somebody. We subtract the $10,050,000 from $50,000, which conveniently becomes $10 million, and we divide that by 1 million shares that are outstanding, and we wind up with a $10 NAV, net asset value. Got it? And this example also has a sales commission of 5%, this mutual fund. So you multiply the $10 of net asset value by the 5%, and you get 50 cents of commissions for a $10.50 offering price. That's what it's called, the offering price. Most people will never remember that, and if you don't worry about it. But that's what it's called, the offering price. Now, let's take a look at the differences between open-end and closed-end funds, the advantages and disadvantages. Well, for the open-end investment company, you have no market forces to deal with. You can always buy, you can always sell. The mutual fund company will always let you buy more shares, will always let you sell your shares. Of course, open-end mutual funds are far more popular, far wider range of choices. And here's the problem with open-end funds. That's not a problem for you or me. I mean, we're the investors. But if you're the investment company, if you're the mutual fund, if, say, you do pretty well last year and everybody turns around and looks at you and says, wow, you did pretty well, then what's going to happen? Right? Money's going to flow into you. And say you don't do that well, money's going to flow away. So what happens is large purchases or redemptions, either way, can make the management of the fund more difficult. Why is that? Well, think about it, folks. If you're trying to manage all this money, and all of a sudden, people throw another, you have a couple billion dollars to invest, and people throw another couple billion at you, right, it's a terrible problem to have, right? No, well, it can be. And for this reason, many mutual fund companies will close the fund to new investors. Because, hey, we got too much money. We don't know what to do with it. You know, we already have everything we want to buy. We don't want to buy more of it. Well, maybe we need to. Maybe we need to find some other alternatives. We need to diversify. It can be a problem. And it can be the worst problem is when people start pulling money out, such as there's a market downturn and people run for the exit. Well, you're a mutual fund manager. You have to redeem those shares. You have to basically pay the people back their money. So you might have to sell some securities, some stocks and bonds at the very worst time when the market's down. So it turns out that open-end mutual funds are a little harder to manage than their cousins, the closed-end mutual fund. Because the closed-end mutual fund, you have some disadvantages. You have to pay the broker's commission. You have to buy them on the exchanges, on the stock markets, in the marketplace. And so often they're sold at a premium if they're very popular, or a discount if they're not that popular. But from the standpoint of the mutual fund manager, the very last bullet we have here, they're far easier to manage than open-end mutual funds. Why? Because you don't have to create any more shares. You don't have to redeem any shares. You know how many shares you have. You know how much money you have. And you can invest it for the long term. And if the market tanks, what do you care? It's not your problem. You can even put more money in, because the people who are trying to sell your fund, they don't sell it from you. You don't have to buy it back from them. You just allow the marketplace you let the people in the market, the investors in the market, buy and sell it. So you see, a closed-end fund is actually easier to manage from the standpoint of the mutual fund manager. For us as investors, you know, it's not that big a deal. So which would or which do you prefer? Well, folks, the reality is very few of us will ever get involved in closed-end funds. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't. It's not that big a universe, and there's not that many of them available, and some brokers swear by them. That's all they want for their clients. I've only met a few that did. Most other brokers just kind of say, yeah, well, there's not that many of them, and they're not that popular, and I'm not interested. And I've noticed that true for investors. I actually know no investors personally who've ever dabbled in these. So doesn't mean there aren't. Obviously there are. Slide number 13. Okay, so we just spent, 10 minutes? Not quite 10 minutes, but we just spent quite a bit of time discussing open-end versus closed-end. And you know what? A whole new type of mutual fund has burst onto the scene and created quite a stir, and those are called ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Now, you most likely are going to hear about these, especially if you get involved in investing, because there are going to be many people who are telling you, oh, are you going to jump on the ETF bandwagon? And there are some reasons why these are popular. Let's just read on slide number 13. An exchange-traded fund is an open-end mutual fund that trades on the exchanges like closed-end mutual funds. So they're a mix. They're a bit of a hybrid, aren't they? Now, they're not called a hybrid security. When I use the term hybrid, I'm talking about they're a mixture of open-end and closed-end funds. There is no limit to the number of shares. So as there's more demand for the shares, they are created on the open market, and as there's less demand, they are redeemed. But the investor must purchase the fund using a brokerage account from another investor. So you need to have a brokerage account to buy and sell these things. You don't go directly to the mutual fund company. And so you incur brokerage commission fees. You incur transaction fees. One of the interesting developments is that some of the mutual fund companies, the two biggest doing this are Fidelity and Vanguard. Fidelity was first, but now Vanguard said, oh, we can do that too. They have a brokerage firm associated with Fidelity, I forget what it's called, but they just lump it under one umbrella called Fidelity, but Fidelity is a mutual fund company, and they have a brokerage firm. And the same thing now for Vanguard. And what they let you do, very brilliant, this is very brilliant, they let you buy and sell their ETFs, Fidelity's ETFs or Vanguard's ETFs, without any commissions. Now, I'm positive there must be a limit to how often you can do this. I haven't looked into it, but I'm if they don't, I can imagine people buying and selling these things all the time, and I feel sorry for both the investor and for Fidelity or Vanguard, but I'm sure, I know Vanguard would not allow that to happen. Let's read together at the bottom of slide number 13. A recent entry to the industry, exchange-traded funds are becoming increasingly popular. At the end of 2011, there were 1,166 ETFs totaling over $1 trillion, $1,048 billion, or $1 trillion. So you see, still far less than the open end, but notice that this number is growing exponentially. At the end of 2010, there were 950, totaling $992 billion. Well, that makes sense. 2011 was a flat year. Still grew. At the end of 2009, there were 820, totaling $777 billion. At the end of 2008, they were down to 531. And at the end of 2007, they were 608. You see, 2008 was rough. And at the end of 2006, there were 359, totaling $423 billion. So if you graph this, you see that with the exception of 2008, the ETF world is growing. And as I checked, they now, this was the end of November, the number I saw was $1.3 trillion. So it's again, taken another steep jump. Now, part of that is because the market did fairly well in 2012. Another part of it is that people are just thinking these are the best things since sliced bread, ETFs. And we're going to see why as we go along. We'll continue. Slide number 14. How are mutual funds regulated? Most people do not really investigate this. They just take it for granted that they're fairly safe. And so you, dear students, because you're in Business 123 in Introduction to Investments and are going to be the guru at your workplace or in your family or amongst your friends, you need to understand how this thing actually works, how this system actually works. Well, before 1940, there were, as we said, dozens of mutual funds, but there was a patchwork of regulations that were dealing with these things, and many of the states and the feds were kind of worried. Okay, we need to get this thing in stone and have it so that everybody does the same thing and we protect the investors. Because remember, a few years ago, before 1940, was the right. You got it, the Great Depression and. Yeah. So the Investment Company Act of 1940 was the foundation of the modern mutual fund industry. It defined what is called in the law a regulated investment company, also known as a pass-through investment vehicle. And so what happens is that the mutual fund company does not deal with the IRS. I mean, obviously they have to communicate to them. But normally when a company makes money, the IRS, the government, or the states say, you owe us some taxes. And the mutual funds say, no, you don't understand. We're investing on behalf of these investors. We didn't make this money. Our investors made this money. Okay, all right. So you will be a pass-through investment vehicle. You will pass through those rewards, dividends, capital gains, interest payments. You will pass them through to your shareholders, and the shareholders will pay the taxes. Cool? Yeah, cool. And to qualify, an investment company must hold almost all of its assets as investments in stocks, bonds, and other traditional securities, very limited ability to use derivatives and other risky strategies. Do you understand? No. You stick to your knitting. You are a stock mutual fund, you invest in stocks. You're a bond mutual fund, you invest in bonds. And then a few others, preferred and a lot like, but those are the two biggies, stocks and bonds. And you can use no more than 5% of your assets when acquiring a particular security. Now, what does that mean? Well, remember, we want professional money management and we want diversification. So the law states that a mutual fund cannot use more than 5% of its assets to buy any individual security. Let's say stock. That means they have to have at least 20 stocks, right? Divide 100% by 5, and you understand the idea. Now, most mutual funds have a whole lot more than 20 stocks. But that's the idea. They're enforcing, or bonds, they're enforcing diversification. You understand? Now, you may, and I'll go see if I can find one and put it up on there on the web, you may come across a mutual fund that has more than 5% of its if its assets in a single stock. And you'll say, wait a minute, Piano told me that they're not allowed to do that. Well, they're not allowed to buy, they're not allowed to use their assets to buy more than 5%. But if they buy a company and it does spectacularly well, such that it grows to the point that it's more than 5%, they are allowed to hold on to it. They don't have to sell it. They cannot purchase any more. They are not allowed to buy more, but they are allowed to hold on to it. And I remember one guy who, he's retired, but he was a great guy. I just very irreverent, and I loved to listen to him and read his interviews. He was a big fan of Philip Morris, the Siggy company, and he had at one time 12% of his mutual fund, because Philip Morris had just done so well. 12% of his mutual fund was Philip Morris, and they interviewed him. Don't you want to sell something? He goes, no, I want to buy more. Of course, he wasn't allowed to, but he's retired. David Draymond? What was his first name? Draymond was his last name. I can't remember. Donald Draymond, right? David Draymond. Look it up. Dreman. His mutual funds were bought by Scudder, I think. And then the last thing that the Investment Company Act requires is that they have to create an organization with checks and balances. Checks and balances. What, does that sound familiar? Yeah, our government's supposed to have checks and balances. And so here's the organization on slide 15. And this is from your book. Now, I would have turned it upside down. I would have, you know, they have the shareholders at the top. For me, the shareholders are the base. They're the base of the mutual fund. And the shareholders are protected by the board of directors. The board of directors, 75% of whom must be independent of the organization, oversee the fund's activity. They approve contracts with the management company, the people making the decisions about which stocks to buy or sell, the certain other service providers whose contracts usually represent the majority of fees paid by fund shareholders. In other words, their job is to oversee the mutual fund on investors' behalf. They have in the past been accused of being rubber-stamped organizations. In other words, whatever the management company says, no problem, because these people get treated really well. Sometimes they get compensation. Sometimes they just get, you know, perks like being flown around the world. This year we're going to have our annual meeting in Aruba. And so that's changed. You know, after 2002, after 2008, mutual fund boards of directors are supposed to be far more stringent, far more rigorous in their investigation of what's going on, so there's no hanky-panky. And then we have the mutual fund itself, which is composed of various components. The most important, from an investor's standpoint, is the investment company, the management company. Why? Because these are the people who are making the decisions. And they usually, but not always, get the lion's share of the funds that are being charged to you, to us, the investors. Because it's not an easy job, folks. A good investment company, a good investment advisor management company, has investment professionals all around the world, because the world is global, and that's not cheap. The distributor sells the shares through brokerage firms or directly to the public. The custodian actually holds on to the assets, maintaining them separately to protect the shareholders' interest. In other words, these people, the investment advisors, say, we want to buy, you know, $100,000 worth of IBM. And who actually holds on to the funds? The custodian. You understand? Yeah. In other words, sure, you tell me what to buy, I'll go buy it, and I'll hang on to it. And then the transfer agent is the organization which processes the orders to buy and redeem the fund shares. For me, I think these are the most, not the most, obviously, the people making the decisions are most important. But for me, these people are very important because they're the ones who basically deal with the brokers and the public. When you call up somebody, you're talking to the transfer agent. You understand? Because they're the ones handling all the transactions, and they're the people. You're not going to talk to the people making the investment decisions. You're going to talk to these people. So that should be a good organization because that's customer service oriented. And then there's an independent public accountant that whose job it is to make sure everything's being done correctly. Okay, you folks in the investment advisor in the management company said you bought 100,000 shares of Microsoft. Where are they? They go over to the custodian. Custodian says, cool, here they are. Here they are. They're sitting in this account over here. You remember Bernie? Right, Bernie Madoff. Right. Exactly. His independent public accountant was some guy in who worked out of his garage somewhere in Connecticut, I think. Yeah. No, the independent public accountants are usually, they used to call them the Big Eight. There aren't eight anymore, but the big firms like KPMG and Ernst, Price, Waterhouse, Cooper, or something like that. I'm not sure exactly all their names. Deloitte and Touche. So the next couple of slides, 16 and 17, are really, folks, just describing what I just went through using the graph. The mutual fund is a corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders. The shareholders actually vote them in. Many shareholders don't even bother to send in their votes. The investment advisor, the management company, is the company that actually makes the decision. They usually have a single portfolio manager, the star manager, the portfolio counselor, the money manager, the mutual fund manager. Sometimes it's a team, and sometimes it's a committee. Now, what's the difference between a team and a committee? Well, a team usually works together, but they make their own decisions, whereas a committee needs to come to some kind of consensus. So that's a subtle difference, and we'll discuss that later on if we do. The research analysts are the up-and-coming individuals who focus on a specific industry. They will be told, go out there and go check out all the car companies. Go knock on the door to Ford. Go knock on the door of GM. And then, eventually, they normally want to move into the portfolio manager position. That's their goal, usually. The distributors are the people, we said, who distribute the shares to the public, much the same role as an investment bank, and we'll talk about initial public offerings in Chapter 5. Slide number 17, the custodian actually holds on to the securities. It's often a bank or a trust company. You might have heard of State Street Bank and Trust, or State Street Bank? I'm not sure if it's called and Trust. This company, very large, is one of the reasons, they're not the only one out there, but they're one of the biggest ones. This is one of the reasons there are so many mutual fund companies, because all you got to do is scrape together some funds, and this company will essentially make it very easy for you to start a mutual fund. They do all the back office stuff. They hang on to the securities. They make it very easy. They're not the only ones, but they're very big. State Street is called. The transfer agent, they're the people who actually deal with the public and keep track of the purchase and redemption requests. And we talked about the independent public accounting firm that certifies the fund's financial reports, make sure there's no hanky-panky, trucos, travesuras. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, folks, mutual funds are highly regulated, $14 trillion, in order to protect shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company, huh? How often? You don't. Until 2003, never. What? Wait a minute, Payano. Slide number 18. Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, as a matter of fact, I do, and folks, it wasn't that big a deal. I mean, it was not good, but and since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. You like that word, impropriety? Right, it means hanky-panky. In 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, folks, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. Only a handful of funds and people were affected. Strong Funds, Janus, Bank of Armenia, Bank of Australia, America, Putnam, poor George Putnam rolling around in his grave thinking, what could they do? And Alliance, you gotta really pity Alliance. There were two people doing this in the whole organization. One of the largest mutual fund companies, not as large because they got hammered when people realized this. And it was only two people. The vast majority of companies never engaged in any of these shenanigans. And folks, what were they doing? Well, I don't want to go into detail, but they were taking pennies from you. Taking pennies from the other investors. Which is, you know, it's not right, and they shouldn't have done it, and we ain't going to do it no more. But it wasn't like Enron, or WorldCom, or Global Crossing, or Madoff. Instead of losing $99,999 on a $100,000 account, which many people did, folks, many people who had all their 401k in the company stock at Enron wound up with nothing, investors lost a buck. Not even. They maybe lost 15 cents or 20 cents on a $100,000 account. It's still theft, and when you have, you know, 100,000 investors, it adds up, right? Pennies add up. But still, it wasn't that big a deal, and it won't happen again, at least not this way, right? And, okay, so example, what were they doing? You're probably wondering, come on, Piano, explain, right? If you don't understand, that's okay, don't worry. But think about it. The world is global, is it not? Yes, it is. And we are connected instantaneously with what's going on around the world. So if the market tanks in the United States at 4 o'clock New York time, 1 o'clock our time, the market's going to close, and the mutual fund managers are then required to sum up all the amounts in their mutual funds and report the net asset value. Well, within a couple of hours, the market's going to open up in Japan. So here's an example of what they would do. If they had a Japanese fund, they would, and the market tanked in the United States, the idea being that the market's going to tank in Japan in a few hours, they would sell their Japanese fund at the 4 p.m. price in New York, and then buy it back the next day when the market tanked the next day in Japan, you see? So say the price was $10. They would sell it for $10 in New York or at New York time at one day, and then the next day it might drop to $9.80, you know, 20 cent drop, which is, you know, not that big a drop, but it's still a drop, and they buy it back. You see what they're doing? Mutual funds are long-term investments. You're not supposed to be buying and selling these things all the time. And people inside the funds were doing this and making, you know, what to you and I seemed like a lot of money, but to them, no. The guy who started Strong Funds, his last name was Strong, he was involved with this. Now, folks, this guy, you just can't, you and I cannot relate. This guy was worth $600 million. He had started this company from scratch, turned it into a very strong, ha ha ha, no pun intended, mutual fund company. And by most accounts, doing this, buying and selling, not illegal, wasn't illegal, but certainly unethical, he profited about $80,000. Now, to you and me, $80,000 is a lot of money. But to some guy who's worth $600 million, and he was destroyed. He literally, he came out, publicly apologized, and said, I don't know what I was doing. I ruined my life. I destroyed my reputation. I ruined the lives of everybody around me. He's barred from the industry for life. And for what? for him, you know, pocket money. But they interview these people, and they just say, look, I thought I was invincible. I thought the rules didn't apply to me. And this is what happens to you when power, and this, you know, money is power, and when that it swallows you up. So you have to be careful. if you or I ever are in this position. Okay, so what do you think, folks? Go back and, great, do it again. And you need to know this stuff because you're now the expert when it comes to mutual funds, at least as far as your friends and family and coworkers are considered. When we come back, we will spend some time discussing fees. So make sure you go back and review this stuff and then get ready to put your fee cap on. How are we being charged? See you in the next presentation.